Welcome. For years, I was on the inside. I saw how power really works, how decisions are made, how secrets are kept. Then I exposed the truth about the deep state, and the deep state tried to ruin my life. But they failed. Because the American people deserve to know who is pulling the strings and why. This isn't theory, it's experience. It's my experience. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. I want to bring on now Judge Andrew Napolitano, really one of my favorite people. Judge Napolitano really needs no introduction, but he is a former judge, a political commentator, and podcaster. Judge Napolitano, welcome. I want to point out at the outset, you are a longtime observer of international events, a keen observer. Before you were a podcaster, you were a broadcaster with Fox News. So you've watched wars come and go. You've watched international negotiations take place, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. I have to admit to you, I am genuinely stumped by what I'm watching right now in terms of U.S. policy toward Iran. The United States and Israel made a decision to attack Iran. It appears that there was a belief, whether it was based on intelligence or not, we don't yet know. There was a belief that when the first missile was fired, the Iranian government would collapse like a house of cards. That's not what happened. Now, it may be that the Israelis, and perhaps the Israelis and the Americans, were listening to the likes of the MEK, the Mujahideen e Khalq, and their biased so-called intelligence. Or maybe we just got it wrong and it was an intelligence failure. What do you think we're looking at in Iran right now? Was there a policy at the outset? And if so, what do you think that policy was?
I think you probably have I know you have a better understanding of the intelligence community than I do. But my understanding of what happened from the people I've interviewed, people like you and friends and colleagues and former coworkers of yours, intelligence community veterans, academics, and military veterans, have given me to understand that the United States intelligence community, along with MI6, was of one mind that the Iranians were not developing a nuclear weapon and had not been doing so since 2003.
Right.
That's 13 years ago. However, the Mossad persuaded Prime Minister Netanyahu, and Prime Minister Netanyahu persuaded President Trump that both Israel and the United States were in grave danger from the Iranians, and the only way to neutralize that danger was to commence a major assault against them. That, of course, was not true, but it was based upon the longstanding desire of the Israeli government to obliterate the regime in Iran and to divide the country into a half dozen smaller, weaker countries, much as they did with Syria. Trump was pressured by Netanyahu. Trump was also pressured by his Zionist supporters in the United States, and he went along with this nonsense. It's utter nonsense. He said as recently as 2 days ago that the Iranians could have struck the United States with a nuclear weapon in 2 days. That, of course, has been refuted by every serious intelligence analyst on this side of the Atlantic, along with the British, soundly and consistently. President Trump also accepted the idea that once the missiles started and the Ayatollah was killed, there'd be spontaneous chaos and riots in the streets, and the riots would lead to an overthrow of the government. That also was fictional. We know it didn't happen. The missiles landed. The Ayatollah was murdered. There were no riots in the streets that succeeded in overthrowing the government. So in my view, this is Israel's war, not the United States' war, not Europe's war, not NATO's war. And it was all perpetrated because Trump was tricked into going along with what his donors in this country and Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted him to do. Netanyahu, in my view, is a war criminal, utterly unworthy of belief. He should be incarcerated prosecuted and convicted rather than leading people into war.
We could end the show right there because I agree with every word that you just said. In all seriousness, I want to probe down a little more. I've said a couple of times publicly that in all my years at the CIA, and even before I arrived at the CIA, literally every time an Israeli prime minister would come to Washington, literally every time that prime minister, whomever he happened to be, would meet with an American president, he would ask the American president, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran. And every president said no, until this one. You made a very important point that the intelligence community, the sense of the American intelligence community was that the Iranians did not have a nuclear program. They did not have a nuclear weapon. They were not 6 weeks from a nuclear weapon or 6 months or 6 years. There was no nuclear program. They've been consistent with that. Indeed, Ayatollah Khamenei had issued a fatwa in 2003 forbidding the Iranian government from developing a nuclear weapon. So how is it that Donald Trump was convinced that there was such a program and that the use of an Iranian nuke was imminent? How was Benjamin Netanyahu able to trick him despite this sense of the intelligence community analysis that the information was just simply not true?
Well, the question presumes that Donald Trump himself believes and believed what he said. So I don't know if Benjamin Netanyahu actually intellectually succeeded in persuading Trump of this, or if the two of them went along with this because of Trump's desire to fulfill the wishes and aspirations of his donors in the United States, particularly the Zionist donors, especially Mrs. Adelson, Dr. Adelson, I should say, as well as pleasing his friends in the Israeli government. Whether Trump honestly believed what Netanyahu said, or whether he just went along with it, who will know? We may never know. History may never know. But it is clear that when they met at Mar-a-Lago shortly before New Year's Eve last year, so we're now on December 29th, December 30th, 2025, they agreed to wage this attack in the middle of January. At the last minute, Netanyahu called Trump and said, we need to delay this for a month. We're not ready. So Trump delayed it until the end of February when the Iranians thought they were legitimately engaged in a legitimate negotiation. Mm-hmm. And for the second time in 8 months, because the same thing happened in June, as they're on their way to meet with what they thought were legitimate American negotiators, the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Israel attacked. Mm-hmm. So the negotiations were a subterfuge. What Trump honestly believed, I don't know. He never actually stated that he was doing this for Israel. Secretary of State Rubio did. Trump has given a variety of reasons for doing this, none of which was consistent. Back in June, he said, we obliterated their nuclear capability. Right. And then in February, he said, well, they could bomb us in a couple of weeks. They had no ability to bomb the United States with jets, with missiles, or with nuclear weapons. Anybody who has even a rudimentary understanding of the Iranian capability knows that. But Trump articulated it in a way either to talk himself into it or to keep his congressional critics at bay or to animate his political base.
I want to ask you about the conversation that's taking place within the Republican Party. Like a lot of Americans, I really believed that Donald Trump, in the form of the MAGA movement, was the anti-war faction. And he kind of, sort of seemed that way in the first term for the most part. But Marco Rubio was never a MAGA Republican. He's always been an expansionist. He's always been more aligned with, let's say, the American Enterprise Institute than with the libertarians. Has the expansionist, let's call it the John McCain, Lindsey Graham wing of the Republican Party, ascended again? Is this the end of MAGA, or has Donald Trump changed his personal ideology?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that he has surrounded himself with neocons. The only non-neocons in his inner circle are his vice president and his director of national intelligence, whom you and I know. He has excluded her. He certainly excluded her from the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. I don't know what he's excluded her from with respect to Iran. But when he was reminded aboard Air Force One that last March she testified under oath that it was the consensus of the American intelligence community, you know what that means. That's not just the CIA, your former employers. That's all 17, including the military ones and the domestic ones, intelligence communities that are adjuncts of the federal government, were of the unanimous opinion that Iran had not been working on a nuclear weapon since 2003. When he was reminded of this, he said simply, "I don't care what she says, I think they are." Now, "I think they are" means this is what Mossad told Netanyahu, and this is what Netanyahu told me. Whether he truly believes this or not, who knows?
Who knows? Well, thank you, Judge Knapp. Please stay right there. When we come back, we're going to have more with Judge Napolitano. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Don't go away. Welcome back to The Deep State. I'm John Kiriakou. Judge Napolitano, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate you doing
this. Sure, John.
So we were talking about the Republican Party, and you noted something that a lot of people are talking about in Washington right now. It's the fact that, by all accounts, the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, and the Vice President, J.D. Vance, were not necessarily all in on this attack. It's unclear, as I noted a few minutes ago, where the intelligence has been coming from, or even if there is intelligence, we really don't know. We know that the Israelis have quite an extensive intelligence network in Iran. They brag about it all the time. We know that they're working with the Mujahideen-e Khalq, the MEK, which until 2009, the State Department listed as a terrorist group until the Obama administration took that group off the list of terrorists. So what does this mean for the rest of U.S. foreign policy? And I'll add one thing that I would appreciate your views on. I've been a regular visitor to the Persian Gulf, and a year ago, the president fired 44 career diplomats, including the U.S. ambassadors to Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman. Those positions have not been filled. Now, it's almost impossible to prosecute a war when you have no senior American official with whom to liaise. One Gulf Arab senior leader told me that his government simply did not know what the U.S. policy was in the Persian Gulf vis-a-vis this war. Why do you think this is, and why hasn't Marco Rubio demanded that these positions be filled?
Well, Donald Trump's a very unorthodox president, as we know. He seems to move from his gut instincts rather than from the result of a deliberative process. Now, Marco Rubio is the de jure, by law, Secretary of State, but he's not the de facto, as a matter of fact, the Secretary of State. He does not get involved in negotiations with the foreign countries because the president probably doesn't trust him. Instead, the president has humiliated him by installing two real estate agents to do the negotiations for him. Mm-hmm. One, his former business partner and collaborator in New York City, Steve Witkoff. The other, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Neither has any experience in international diplomacy. So I can't tell you why those posts are still empty. many ambassadorial posts throughout the world. American ambassadorial posts under Donald Trump have been filled by people with no diplomatic experience whatsoever, but they're personal friends of his or donors to his or his friends and colleagues' campaigns. It's an unorthodox foreign policy. As I said earlier, John, seems to be motivated by the president's gut instincts rather than a deliberative process.
I wanted to ask you, too, about the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. You know Pete Hegseth well. You worked with him at Fox News before he moved into government. It's difficult for me to understand his policy positions as well. I know that in the very beginning of this term, he had difficult relations with members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Many of them have been replaced. And it appears that Hegseth is calling the shots. Give us an assessment of his performance at DOD. And do you think that militarily he's able to command victory in this fight with the Iranians?
Well, if you had asked me if militarily he's able to command respect, I will tell you no. The generals and admirals have no respect for him. He lost what little respect he had by virtue of occupying a superior office to theirs when he gave that George Patton-like speech to all of the admirals and generals in the world, which he ordered to assemble before him in one room in Quantico, Virginia. Pete is a performance artist. The Pete that I know is a nice guy. I worked with him closely for 10 years. The Pete that I see on television is a madman who glories in killing people, who's probably committed war crimes, who's probably committed murder. I'm talking about killing of people, fishermen and fishing boats and speedboats in the Caribbean, who seems to glory in the strength that he has at his command, at his fingertips. I don't know anything about General Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but I can tell you that the Americans and the Israelis grossly underestimated the Iranian reserve, the Iranian stability, the Iranian military strength, the loyalty that the overwhelming majority, well into the 90 percentile, of people have for their government, the strategic nature of Iran's offensive weaponry. All of this was grossly underestimated. If Pete Hegseth told Donald Trump what Trump told the American people, this will be over in a weekend. It was such a gross miscalculation as to be the revelation of manifest incompetence of such a nature as to disqualify him from remaining in that office. Now, I don't know if Donald Trump agrees with me. I suspect he doesn't. But it seems rather obvious that this was poorly planned, poorly thought out, and sold the president a bill of goods.
You know, I want to ask you about what this all means for the future of the Arab states in the Persian Gulf. I'm speaking specifically of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. If these countries agreed years ago to host American ground forces, as the Kuwaitis, the Omanis, the Emiratis, and the Saudis have, the headquarters of the Fifth Fleet, which the Bahrainis have, and the largest U.S. airbase in the world, which the Qataris have, and the United States has been unable to protect those countries and their economic interests, I'm thinking specifically of Dubai and Abu Dhabi right now, wouldn't that make their leaders question whether or not it's even worth having an American military presence in their countries? The idea is that the Americans are going to be there to protect them from what Saddam Hussein's Iraq had done to the Kuwaitis in 1991 or 1990, to protect them against this Iranian behemoth that it turned out didn't exist anyway. But if you can't even stop a $10,000 drone from crashing into the side of a hotel or from taking out the runway of an airport in Kuwait or Bahrain, then why have the Americans there at all? Do you think that these are the conversations that are taking place in the Gulf right now?
I don't know if those conversations are taking place in Saudi Arabia because of the unique relationship with the United States and the huge investments that the Trump family has in Saudi Arabia. But I'm sure that these conversations are taking place with all the other Gulf states. The United States was either unwilling or unable to defend them in their maximum hours of danger and still is unable to defend them. So one wonders, for what purpose is the United States there? They don't need the economic stimulation from the presence of tens of thousands of troops, and they're not getting any defensive capability. John, I'm going to have to run, but I must tell you, I enjoyed my time with you. This is a great program. I look forward to coming back with you, and I hope you can join mine when your busy schedule allows.
That's a big yes. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John. All the best.
And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.